there's a whole ecosystem of companies out there. You know, what happens in reality is that if you choose a platform, they're going to try to do the attribution for you. So, and this goes for not just Meta and Google, but also like, you know, an independent company like Mountain, some of you listeners may have tried, or Vibe, these new like video optimization systems. They're going to do the attribution for you. And their attribution is only going to know what it knows. So, you know, it doesn't know what happened on Meta. The same consumer, the same human being saw your ad on a video ad on Peacock, let's say, and then they had Meta, Facebook's blue app open, and they watched a video there. The two systems don't know about each other. And so you end up with a mess, basically.
This is the Let's Talk Marketing podcast, and I am your host, Katya Allison. And on the LTM pod, we cut through the noise to make marketing accessible, actionable, and a little more fun. Every episode, you're going to walk away with insights you can apply to your business and sometimes even your life. So grab your favorite beverage, sit back, and let's dive into it. Let's talk marketing. Ari, welcome to the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. Very excited to have you on here today. We're going to unpack your book a little bit, but also talk about just what does that mean to us as marketers. So welcome.
Thanks, Katya. I'm excited to be here.
Excellent. Well, let's have you introduce yourself to the audience. I usually ask the tried and true question, what was your first marketing job, whether it had marketing in the title or it didn't?
Sure. I'm Ari Papara. I'm the author of Yield. I'm a 20-year veteran of the ad tech world. So I worked at Google and DoubleClick and a bunch of other companies you may have heard of that have to do with programmatic advertising. I would say my first marketing role probably predates programmatic. It was a dot-com startup in 1999 that we raised a crazy amount of money so that we could do bookmarks in the cloud. Basically, you know, the same way back in the day, you had email on your computer and then Hotmail came out and you could have email in a web browser, right? And so the same thing went for like the favorites or bookmarks in your browser. You would, back then, you'd switch browsers or you'd switch computers and you'd lose them all. You couldn't log into your browser. So we let you sync them in the cloud and access them anywhere. It's called blink.com. And I was sort of the man about town. I did BD, marketing, customer acquisition. It was the dot-com days, so you do these swap deals where you'd like buy a million users and then give them a million users and all this crazy stuff. So that's probably where I got my entry.
I love the dot-com era. I grew up in the Silicon Valley, so it's like runs in my blood for sure. Now that's where those were your humble beginnings. Where are you now? What are you doing?
Yeah, so I am an author and a podcaster like you. I have a podcast called Marketecture. It's like architecture with an M on it, it's very in-depth, like how the trains run on time and how the plumbing works of advertising. I also write a newsletter and do a bunch of other consulting and other things. I'm just sort of an expert in everything ad tech at this point.
I love it. And this is why we're going to dive into this kind of ad tech world. And more specifically, we'll start with your book. Now, in your book, Yield, Y-E-L-D, you kind of lay out how Google went from being just a search engine to basically running this whole digital ad game. Yeah. Now, for marketers who watched it kind of happen and uncover, but may not really truly fully understand the nuts and bolts of it. Can you just break down what exactly did Google build and why did it make them such a powerhouse?
Yeah. So I'll try to take the perspective of someone who doesn't pay attention to this sort of stuff. Someone who's maybe just been logging into Google AdWords for 10 or 15 years. And you may have noticed, if you go back in your memory, that it used to be that you logged into Google AdWords and bought a bunch of keywords and put in some text ads. And that was pretty much it. That was it. You were buying search in various ways and it was really effective and it was great. And then at some point, things sort of changed and you were buying image ads or Google was auto-creating image ads from your text ads, or they were saying, hey, it'd be great if you uploaded a video. And now we're now at the point in 2025 where if you log into AdWords, they basically say, you know, what's your budget? We'll do everything for you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Trust us.
and they have a thing called PMAX, which puts your budget, you know, who knows where. Okay, so that's the perspective of the advertiser. What my book talks about is the perspective of the publisher. So, you know, the folks trying to make money out there on ads, the CNNs and New York Times and, you know, Reddits of the world. And what happened was, this is why I wrote the book, because it's kind of an interesting story, which is it used to be human beings. It used to be that you had a big sales force who was well paid, who had expense accounts, and they sold all your ads for you. And maybe you outsourced to another firm who did it for you, but they were also human beings. Contract with other human beings. And right around the late 2000s, like 2007-8, the entire market changed. It became like the stock market, bought and sold in milliseconds. It was financialized, and that's sometimes called programmatic advertising, and probably many people have heard that term. And so that was this revolution where computers were buying those ads in milliseconds across the globe with algorithms and AI and all that stuff. And what happened was that seemed like it was a good idea, because in the short term, it made publishers a little extra money. They were able to sell stuff they couldn't sell, and they also could reduce the, you know, expense of all those salespeople, right? But the counter effect was that a giant company like Google could effectively corner the market with their tech, where they were able to take all those dollars from the AdWords users and move them wherever on the chessboard they wanted to win. And they also controlled the sell side. They have the technology that virtually every publisher uses to determine what ads show on their site. It's called GAM. Many people also may have heard of that. So GAM and AdWords connect. Google makes money every hop of the way. And in 2025, currently, in some segments of this like advertising world outside of search, Google has 90% share of some of the sectors. And they really buy, sell, measure, and do everything else on a huge portion of the ads that are in websites, in apps, on your TV, and really everywhere else.
Yeah, I know that for myself, sometimes it feels like there's this vice grip from Google of like, you've got to have, even from like an SEO perspective, right? Like you kind of have to have all your ducks in a row in order for, and then it changes, right? And then you're like, okay, well, wait a second. Now I have all my ducks in a row, and then it changes, and it's really dictated by Google versus, or at least this is what it feels like, right?
It feels that way.
Yeah, it feels like it's dictated by Google. Versus being dictated by how people are truly searching. And so always just kind of leaves you questioning, wait, is this truly what people are searching for and how people are searching?
Yeah, a lot of people have read my book or looked at my book and said, oh, you hate Google. Google, don't be evil, is that stuff. And I do not. That is not the point. Google is not doing things that are clearly immoral in this book. It's much more about sort of a mixture of arrogance and bullying and gaslighting. You know, this is one of the inspirations for the book, was that I was sitting in the courthouse in Virginia listening to the trial, the Department of Justice antitrust trial against Google, and the testimony of some of the folks on stand was dramatic. It was like people saying they lied to me. They treated me like an idiot, even though I was one of their biggest customers. You know, they wouldn't tell me the truth about how their auctions worked. And then when I found out, I realized they were lying. You know, that sort of stuff that really doesn't make you a lot of friends, whether it's immoral or not. It really goes in to factor some of these regulatory and legal issues.
Yeah. And, you know, in the history that you kind of outline in your book, it's not like it happened overnight. It's definitely something that built up. And I'm just curious, do you think that there were, what's the best way for me to articulate this? Do you think that there were forks in the road where it could have been different? And if so, what kind of indicators, no, maybe not indicators, what did those stops look like and those forks look like?
Yeah, so early late 2000s, this whole world gets invented, and Google is sort of on a warpath to win it. They acquired the company I worked at called DoubleClick, and that team was really like kind of East Coast advertising centric professionals that really helped create the modern business that Google's dominating. And that was pretty straightforward. But then by the 2010s, the mid teens, we see a lot of emails, and these all came out in the trial, of folks saying things like, it's as if we're both JP Morgan and the New York Stock Exchange. Like, we're on both sides of these transactions, and that can't be right. That's a paraphrase of an actual email that was sent. And then they bring in all these quants, these, like, you know, super machine learning genius people who work at Google, and they give them the mission, like, how do we make more money? And guess what? They figure out ways to make more money, right? When you're buying and selling the same thing on two sides of the transaction, there's a lot of ways to get a little extra money out of that. And those are probably the darker points of the book, where there are emails saying customers aren't going to like this, let's do it anyway, and you know, some pretty high stakes conflict that's going on inside the company.
It really does make you to have been in those rooms where those decisions had been made and those conversations. I don't want to say moral or immoral, but definitely, like, those are tough conversations to be had, right?
Yeah. And in many cases, there are folks who probably didn't think their emails would ever be shown in court who are saying things. You know, they're being really honest.
Exactly. Talk about transparency. It takes it to a whole different level. Yeah. Now, like, because of this, right, like, Google has all of these kind of, they have this antitrust pressure. Do you think anything is going to come of it that truly affects their grip in this digital space?
Yeah. So we're going to go I'm going to go down to Virginia in a couple of weeks, depending on when this podcast comes out, for the second half of the trial, where the judge has already found them to be a monopolist and will now decide what to do about it. What the Department of Justice is asking for is a divestiture of some of the publisher side products. Mm-hmm. So the ad server, the exchange, et cetera. What does that mean to marketers? Like, if you're a buy side marketer, I'm assuming you're on the buy side, you're buying ads.
Yeah.
Probably not that much. Because once again, if you're using, say, Google Ads and you're using PMax, your money is being spread across search, across YouTube, and across open web display advertising, among maybe some other stuff too. And a divestiture would mostly affect that open web display portion of it, which currently only kind of round trips inside Google. And now it would go outside of Google. It would have to, those ads would go other places. But Google would still control where they went. They would still be the ones, you know, controlling the pricing and the bidding. It would just be arm's length. So net-net, probably not much effect at all. If there's anything, it would be that Google will probably emphasize YouTube even more than they currently do in terms of trying to get your money to go there. For the bigger clients who might be listening to this, you might be using DV360, which is Google's like DSP, meaning product for big advertisers to buy ads. That product already spends like 70% of its money on other Google products. So that would change. But once again, it's the whole point of the product is you get to buy whatever ads you want. So it would mean that instead of buying CNN through Google's exchange, you might buy CNN through an external exchange run by somebody else, or even by Google's exchange spun out and owned by somebody else. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Maybe in a cent or two difference, like, the take rate might change slightly.
So I'm not going to feel a dramatic difference as a marketer, but definitely if I'm in the ad tech side, I'm going to see some changes.
Yeah. Or a publisher. Sell side's going to see some big changes if any of this happens. Their partners will change. Their pricing might change. A lot of things might change on the sell side.
Okay. I feel like all of that definitely makes sense. I kind of teased this before we hopped on because Google is so dominant and it has a history of that. I feel like AI is starting to build up to that as well too. I mean, it's obviously been around for a lot longer than people are feeling. I think we're hitting the top of that bubble. But I'm wondering, do you see AI disrupting marketing in the same way that kind of Google started monopolizing?
Yeah. So all the big tech companies have the same vision, which is that you just give them the budget and they figure everything else out. And that's really AI driven. You know, as far back as like, you know, 2003, 2004. So we're really going back in time. You know, Larry Page would say things like that. He would say to agencies, like, all I want is your budget and we'll make it work. And he would get just blasted because everyone hated hearing that. They're like, we're marketers. We know what we're doing. But 20 years later, the AI is there. And the AI can create creatives for you, figure out where to run them, measure them, and optimize them without a lot of human interaction. At least that's the vision that Google and Meta and Amazon and TikTok and everyone else has. And they all have these programs that are called Plus or Max. It's like, you know, PMax and Advantage Plus and TikTok, I forget what TikTok's is called. They all have the same kind of naming convention. And they're AI driven, especially the creative side. The creative side, where if you're a small marketer and you give it just a website and some images, the AI can now create 10 or 20 or 100 different versions of video creative for you that you know could be optimized to results. So that's where AI bets are taking place in the advertising sector, in these kind of closed loop, super optimized systems. If you're a bigger advertiser and you're kind of choosing which vendors to use, like you have a creative vendor separate from your media vendor, then it's a little bit more in your hands as to which AI which parts of the workflow and stack AI helps the most on. Is it creative? Is it planning? Is it optimization? And I think that's where there's a little more creativity going on in the kind of open web programmatic world.
You keep saying open web. Can you define that for me?
Yeah, open web is a tricky definition. Effectively, what it used to mean was the typical website with banner ads. So you know that you know when you see it, the Daily Mail, CNN, that sort of thing. But it's changed a little bit because if you think about where you can buy ads on your own terms, like using a DSP or using your own buying system, it includes places like Spotify, which is very different. Now TV, you know, Peacock and Netflix has ads. So it's not really clear what the definition means anymore. I like to think of it as, where can an advertiser choose what to buy with a lot of granularity and control? Meta, not YouTube, everything besides that.
Not Meta, not YouTube. Everything outside of that would be open web, which that kind of makes sense. What do you think the level of attribution that you get from open web versus like a Meta and a YouTube is? Like, do we have more control over attribution? Is that something that we need to think about as marketers in this space?
Yeah, attribution is an area where if you don't pay attention, you're probably getting ripped off somehow.
That's exactly why I asked. I think it's consistent. It's this, trust me, you're getting the impressions, you're getting the leads, but how good are these leads? How good are these clicks? How good are these impressions? Are they the right people? At what point in their journey? So I feel like I'm always, if I was a meme, I'd be chasing attribution in a car.
Yeah, I mean, and also how is it deduped across channels is a really hard problem.
Exactly.
In open web, historically, attribution has been third-party cookie-based, where someone sees your ad and then they go to your website and you correlate the two things and you assume that correlation is the same as causation, which is the biggest mistake anyone could make, but that's just the way people do it. And you make decisions that way. In modern world where cookies are, you know, not reliable, people use other ways of getting to that correlation, like IP addresses or, you know, third parties like LiveRamp. There's a whole ecosystem of companies out there. You know, what happens in reality is that if you choose a platform, they're going to try to do the attribution for you. So, and this goes for not just Meta and Google, but also like, you know, an independent company like Mountain, some of you listeners may have tried, or Vibe, these new like video optimization systems. They're going to do the attribution for you. And their attribution is only going to know what it knows. So, you know, it doesn't know what happened on Meta. The same consumer, the same human being saw your ad on a video ad on Peacock, let's say, and then they had Meta, Facebook's blue app open and they watched a video there. The two systems don't know about each other. And so you end up with a mess, basically.
I was going to say, Do you know of any technology that brings it all together so that I can have like a full, what is that full customer journey of someone?
There's no, so yes, but it's going to be statistical, right? No one has perfect information, right? No one can know the same user because you just aren't allowed to track the same user inside the walled gardens, outside the walled gardens, et cetera. So there are different options. You know, in the mobile world, there are people like Apps Flyer, and there's a whole bunch of people called mobile media attribution. Is that I don't have that acronym right. that mobile measurement providers, for lack of a better term, that you know do get data from everywhere. You might want to get an app install in the web. Folks generally might use an ad server, like Google's ad server, which is a different product, or you know, a product like MediaOcean does the same thing. There are also independent companies that just do do attribution standalone, like House Analytics, HAUS. I had them on my podcast recently. So they do studies. They do statistical studies. They'll tell you what's working and what's not across all your channels. But it's not going to be 100% accurate. It's an estimate based on, you know, statistics and science.
Yeah, I think as marketers, we're always looking for attribution and then also like the halo effect of everything that we're doing and who gets the credit. That's really what it is.
Yeah.
Who gets the credit so that you can double down on that. And that's where your dollars end up going, which I think is why it feels very invasive to have a company like Google get so large and dominate so much that you're like, I'm just basically giving them all of my dollars. It sounds like I'm personally scorned by Google, but it does kind of feel that way. Like, how do I know what's working and how do I know what's not?
Yeah, and especially when Google Analytics is the dominant platform and they downgrade it, basically, a massive downgrade that probably many of your listeners have experienced to GA4, I forget the number, which, you know, most people say is less effective than the previous version. So it's tough to have a reliance on a tech vendor who may or may not have your interest at heart.
That's true. I also feel like we could probably do a whole episode on GA4 itself.
You should. Not with me.
Where to like find all of your course. I consistently am like, I know. And it's worse when you have had history in the way that it was before. And now it's like wearing your shoes on the wrong foot. And I'm like, how do I... Everything was set up before and now.
I don't know what those designers are smoking. Like, why are any of those choices made? It's just insane. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't look like any other website on the entire internet. It looks like they just designed something from scratch.
I press all the buttons on anything. And so I have so many like reports that I don't even like track. I'm like, well, this would be great, but nothing's set up right. So yeah, that'll be a whole different episode, the whole GA4.
Yeah.
But I'm also really kind of curious, after everything that you sort of uncovered and like uncoupled inside of writing this book, what's your advice to marketers who kind of just don't want to end up at the mercy of like a Google? And like, what's your advice to them?
Yeah. So my advice is to scale up your platforms with your budget. And what I mean by that, maybe this is obvious, is like you start with Google. Google's the must buy. If you have a dollar to spend, it probably goes to Google. Then as soon as you get any scale at all, you add Meta. And then there's kind of, and you go with those two for a while. And then you wait, because it's really probably not worth adding a third or a fourth channel until you get to a certain scale. And then you pick pretty carefully and you look at, you know, is it additional social like Snap, TikTok, whatever, or is it more of a, you know, CTV, connected TV, mountain vibe type company? And you just scale these things kind of incrementally with budget so that you know what's working and what's not, and you don't get ahead of your skis, try to do everything, or try to, you know, mismatch your sophistication with the number of tools.
That's so true. What are your thoughts on connected TV in general?
I love connected TV. It's great. Really? It's a Yeah, it's a living room experience. It scales down. So, you know, the problem with traditional TV was the entry point was so high. You know, you'd have to spend $50,000 to get someone to return your phone call. And then you had to create the videos, which could be another, you know, however much money. Yeah. In connected TV, you can spend as little as $100 to be on real TVs. You can have, you know, targeting. You know, I personally, when I'm sitting in my living room, see ads for ad tech companies on my TV in my living room because I'm in a segment, right?
And I think even more so now than ever before. That's why I'm kind of curious. Like, it feels like that's a little bit on the rise as well, too.
It is. And then AI, the AI for creative, you know, you could create a really nice video creative for free or for $100, which is a huge difference. And it works. It works incredibly well. Now, the only caution is when I say it works, attribution.
Yeah.
Because no one's hitting QR codes, right? No one is clicking with a remote to learn more about your company and your product. Exactly. That's just not happening. They're going on their phone and they're buying something on their phone if the ads work. And then the challenge is that these TV companies, the ones who sell you the ads, they're just desperate for attribution. So they're probably overstating your attribution. Let's just say that. So you have to be just careful with how successful they say your ads have been, but you know that they're working a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel like everything helps a little bit, unless it really doesn't hit your audience. And that's just my opinion. I also sound so jaded. Like, I trust nobody. Google's getting everything. You know, nobody's reporting the correct attribution. But I think there is this little bit of cynicism as being a marketer for over 15 years where you're like, well, I'm never going to take, you know, ad tech X's word for, hey, this is successful. I'm going to take a look at like what my single source of truth is people in my system.
Like, trust no one is a good strategy. Like,
exactly. Which actually kind of leads me to, you know, for the listeners, what would be the one thing that they should do differently, in your opinion, tomorrow from a marketing perspective, with all of this just kind of in mind, with like Google and where ad tech sits?
Yeah. I like turning things off. I like tests where you just turn off YouTube for a week or two. People are always scared to do it.
I know. That's so crazy.
There's no other way to really test. I mean, it depends on the marketer. Like, if you're national, you can turn off certain states. If you're depends on your volume of how many orders you get based on the ads. Like, if you're B2B, probably you don't get that many leads. That's the only way you're going to develop a rule of thumb, an instinct for what works, because numbers are great, but like, you really kind of need an instinct. If you're, you know, if you're turning off YouTube ads for a week and you see sales go down by 10-20% right for a week, you know, you've learned something pretty important. Right. Or maybe they don't go down at all and you learn something else.
Ooh, I like this. I like this. It is a little controversial. It makes you feel just a little uncomfortable, which I don't know. I feel like it's a good sign.
You don't need a PhD to turn something off, right?
Exactly. And the correlation can be really incredibly insightful too. And like you're saying, turn it off for a week. What do you have to lose, right?
What do you have to lose? Don't do it during a weird week. Like, don't turn it off over Christmas or something. Like, you need to turn it off at a real, like, real time. Yeah,
that's not a good science experiment also in general.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Well, this has been so incredibly insightful. I've got one final question. It's the same question that I ask everybody. And that is, if you knew then what you know now, what is the marketing advice that you give to yourself?
Okay, this is going to be controversial.
I love it.
Don't party so hard. Man, if you're in marketing, someone's always willing to buy your drinks, go out every night. Just don't do it. Take it easy, man. It's life,
oh
life goes on.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Did people buy you a lot of drinks? Is that where it's coming from?
Yes.
Yes. You know what the thing is that as marketers, we're just a good time.
No, it's fine. Nothing wrong with it. Just like, you know, take it easy. There's a limit, right? Some folks, especially in agencies, like in their 20s, like, come on, man, you got to dial it back. You got to like take up a hobby that doesn't involve liquid, you know?
Well, you heard it here first. A non-liquid diet as your advice to yourself. Ari, thank you so much for coming on here. I'm so happy that you were on here and then you just kind of shared a little bit of the Google story, shared a little bit of your book as well too.
Thanks so much, Katya. And just a reminder for your readers, it's called Yield, How Google Bought, Built, and Bullied Its Way to Advertising Dominance, and you can buy it on Amazon.
There we go. I did purchase it on Amazon too.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Today, for this episode, I don't actually have a key takeaway or key takeaways. I have a hot take, and here it is. The hot take is the attribution trap. Our survival instincts as marketers are sabotaging our success. We're looking for the security blanket of attribution. We're not chasing attribution because we love data. Okay, some of us do. I am a self-diagnosed data junkie. We are chasing it because we're terrified. Marketing departments are always first on the chopping block when numbers just don't add up. So we've become addicted to having an answer for everything, even when those answers are fundamentally flawed. Here's the brutal truth. Our obsession with attribution isn't actually making us better marketers. It's making us prisoners. And yes, I know how hyperbolic I am being, but what can I say? I'm passionate. So anyways, we're prisoners of the very platforms we should be kind of questioning. When Ari talked about Google's dominance and how they control sort of both sides of these advertising transactions, he wasn't just describing a business strategy. He was describing how our own fears have made us complicit in this kind of captivity. Think about it this way. Google Analytics tells you that your paid search drove 40% of your conversions. Great. Facebook claims 35%. Your email platform, it says it influenced 25%. And suddenly you're at 100% before you've even counted organic search, referrals, or even like kind of any offline impact. But we nod along because each platform gives us something to point to when the CEO asks, what am I spending my money on? That's how a CEO talks in my head. This defensive posture is exactly what these platforms count on. When we're scared of not having an answer, we kind of accept bad answers sometimes. We look into this long-term commitment with Google because their attribution dashboard gives us these colorful charts to show leadership. We double down on Meta because their pixel tracking provides conversion data that looks authoritative in our monthly reports. But here's what Ari kind of revealed that should shake us up to our core. Those internal Google emails showed employees saying, customers aren't going to like this. Let's do it anyway. They know that we need those attribution reports more than we need accuracy sometimes. Our desperation for job security has become their competitive moat. So how do we break free without losing our jobs? We need to shift from defensive attribution to offensive business impact. Instead of saying, for example, Google Analytics shows our paid search converted 500 customers last month, we need to say something more like, when we increased search spend by 20% in Q3, revenue grew by X percent above what we forecasted. And moreover, well, we would write this down. That's why we would say moreover. But, and when we tested pausing it for a week, we saw a 15% dip in qualified leads. Do you hear the difference? This is exactly what Ari was kind of advocating for with this controversial advice about turning channels off. Now, I'm not suggesting that we fly blind. I'm merely suggesting that we build confidence instead of false confidence. So real confidence, not false confidence. When you can definitively say turning off YouTube not all tripped up, turning off YouTube ads for a week resulted in just measurable sales decrease, you've moved from attribution theater to business impact measurement. The irony is that by just kind of chasing this perfect attribution, we've actually made our case for marketing investment weaker, not stronger. Leadership actually sees through those vanity metrics faster than we think. They'd rather hear, I tested this and here's what definitely happened, than the algorithm says this probably worked. Are you up for a challenge? Okay. If you are, pick one marketing channel you're currently measuring through platform attribution. Design a simple test where you pause it for a defined period and measure actual business impact. Yes, it's scary. And yes, you might find out something that you don't want to know, but you're also going to build the kind of evidence that makes marketing budgets recession-proof. This attribution addiction was supposed to make us indispensable. Instead, it's kind of made us dependent. The path to job security isn't through better dashboards, it's through better testing. And sometimes the most powerful test is having the courage to turn something off and see what actually happens to the business. What did you take away from today's episode? I want to hear it. A very special thank you to my podcast editor, Johnny Eich, and thanks to you for spending your time with me today. Until next time, may the conversation flow, the laughter linger, and the outlook remain optimistic but grounded in reality. This is Katya signing off.